Well, thanks for coming. We're going to go ahead and start our Job class today. The subject of today's class, we're going to take a look at Job chapters 26, 27, and 28. It has to do with the question that Job will ask a couple of different times, where does understanding dwell? We're going to read three chapters today that all has to do with Job himself, sharing some thoughts on the things that have happened and his reactions to it, and we're going to watch him as he kind of continues to work through some difficult things. It's kind of a slow realization on Job's part as he sorts through all the things that have happened and all the things that his friends have been saying. And what you notice in these chapters is that he kind of swings back and forth rather violently at times between these sharp, sarcastic comments about his friends and these really grand and majestic things about God. And so it's kind of an interesting journey, so to speak, that Job takes in the course of these three chapters. Okay, now that all the important conversations are finished, John is going to lead us in a time of prayer, and we will get ready to study. Amen. All right. Thanks very much. What we're going to see today is some thoughts, as I mentioned, of Job. Job is going to just talk for the next few chapters about the things that have happened and some of the things that have come to his mind as a result of it. If you enjoyed hearing from Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, you're going to be disappointed because we're not going to hear from them anymore. You know, the Three Stooges have been canceled and we're on to some different things. There will be another guy, Elihu, come in a little bit later on. You know, kind of like those the older Three Stooges shows where Shemp replaces Curly, and so he'll give us some benefit of his infinitesimal wisdom a little bit later. But right now, what we're going to see is Job. These three chapters are in a sense they're kind of the heart of Job's journey to understanding, because what he's doing here is he's kind of reaching a climax in his frustration with his friends. Some of the things that he says in the next couple of chapters are some of the sharpest and most sarcastic things that he has to say about his friends. And then after that, he's going to kind of calm down about that. He's also reaching a point in his understanding of God where he's right on the verge of some very important realizations. And it's some very interesting things. These passages, this particular little section of Job, chapters 26, 27, and 28, some commentators have compared it to a symphony in classical music. The different movements and the give and take and the up and down. And I will, in deference to the taste that I know you all have, I will not stretch that analogy any farther than that. We'll just leave it to those few of you who appreciate good quality music to pursue that more on your own. Let's read Job chapter 26. This is right after Bildad, whom we've looked at last week, has finished with his discussion. And let's see, let's get some readers. Some people hide out in the back expecting that I won't find them to do some reading. So Don, could you read the first four verses? And then Dave, you would appreciate this because you're from the same generation I am. You remember the old Jimmy Page, Robert Plant song, "Your Time Is Gonna Come." So if you could read from verse 5 to the rest of the chapter for us.
Naked is Sheol before him, and Abaddon has no covering. He spreads stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. He wraps up the waters in his cloud, and the cloud does not burst under them. He obscures the face of the full moon and spreads the cloud over it. He has inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are amazed at his rebuke. He quieted the sea with his power, and by his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his breath the heavens are cleared. His hand has pierced the fleeting serpent. Behold, these are the fringes of his ways, and how faint a word we hear of him. But his mighty thunder, who can understand?
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. What you notice in that passage is he says some things about his friends, and he says some things about God, and he says some things about himself. How does he feel about himself right now? And if you can't think of a word of your own, you can just peek at the outline and pick a word in the outline there. Job feels powerless. That's very good, Lloyd. I couldn't have done better myself. That's an excellent word to describe how Job is feeling. He's feeling powerless. He's feeling like he just can't control anything anymore. He's powerless to talk to God and persuade God to listen to him. He's powerless in the face of his friends and their seemingly endless pontifications about their great wisdom. And he says sarcastically to his friends in that first part of the chapter, well, thanks for nothing. You really helped me in my powerlessness here. Now, his friends, what's he have to say about them? Well, they're just pretty insensitive oafs in his mind right now. They're just thoughtless. They don't really understand. They don't really get it. And so he just says, thanks for nothing, guys. Now, in a sense, it's a little bit unfair because the last time we saw Eliphaz and Bildad, they actually had a little bit new to say. They were actually a little bit better. But what you're seeing in Job is just the accumulation of a lot of discouragement and a lot of frustration. This is kind of the point in the book where things are starting to come very sharply into focus. He's becoming increasingly frustrated with the inadequacy of human wisdom. Even these three friends, whom he probably had it for most of his life a very good relationship with, they probably trusted each other, they're just proving woefully inadequate to help him in his time of greatest need. And he himself feels so powerless. What's interesting then is when he turns back to God, though, he says a lot of different things about God. His thoughts about God are much different. He's very well aware of how transcendent God is. He's very well aware of how much more powerful and wise God is. And if there's a problem that's bothering him, it's not with God's character, it's with God's absence. That's the problem that Job keeps struggling with. He has no sense of God's presence. He's very convinced that God knows everything. He's very convinced that if God knew what was going on, he'd have either a good solution or at least a very good answer. But it really bothers him that God is not there. You know, there's an old quote that my mom used to quote to us when we were kids, when we would ask questions that had no answers. It's a quote by this guy named, the poet named George Meredith. Don't hold that against him. She used to say that to us when we really wanted an answer to something that there just wasn't an answer to. It's a quote, and this reflects, she's an English teacher, so it's not a little snappy one-liner. It's, ah, what a dusty answer gets the soul when hot for certainty in this our life. And see, when we were real little, we had no idea what that meant, so it shut us up while we would go and try to figure out what it meant. When you want certainty in this life, when you want a definitive answer to why are things the way in this life, you just get a dusty answer, because there often is no final, complete, perfect answer. It's not always going to make sense the way that we want it to. And so the implication is we have to look a little bit higher. We have to look a little bit farther beyond that. And that's what Job is talking about in this last part of the chapter. He's very well aware of how great God is, how wise God is, but in his own expression, all he can perceive is just a faint whisper. There's this great, glorious God, and Job is frustrated because all he can do is sense a very tiny part of him. Or later he says, I just see the outer fringe of his work. And this is where Job has come now. He's starting to see, yes, the answers are all in God, but I just can't see hardly any of it, just this tiny little faint whisper. And he's getting this sense now of how inadequate the human mind, the mortal mind, is to find these answers. And he's really on the verge of some very significant things. He knows his mind is human, and he knows he's mortal. He's come to grips with death and its implications. And he knows that God transcends even that. This one verse here in verse 6, death is naked before God. Destruction lies uncovered. That to God, even death and destruction are not mysteries. They're not anything that he can't control. And just for those of you who keep track of such things, that's kind of a more general expression, really. The word for death, that's translated death, it's really Sheol in Hebrew. Sheol in Hebrew is really the realm of the dead. It's not really death per se. Sheol is where the dead people go. It's something that in Job's lifetime, they didn't have a concrete doctrine about it. They just referred to this realm, Sheol. That's where we're going to go when we die. That's where our spirits are going to go. This word that's translated destruction, likewise, it really means something different. It's you may have heard this word, Abaddon. It's really Hebrew for nothing or annihilation. It's the elimination of something that once existed, the total annihilation of something that once existed. In Job's lifetime, Sheol and Abaddon were kind of a vague parallel for what we would say heaven and hell. You go to Sheol, you exist someplace, or you go to Abaddon, you're just annihilated, you don't exist anymore. They didn't have, as I said, comprehensive doctrines about those. But what Job is saying is, even what happens to us after we die, that's God knows all about it. He's saying that we have so little ability to grasp that, and yet to God, he transcends that. And what he's saying is that he has a very tiny sense of God's hand at work, but he can see it. And that's what this image is with the imagery of the waters of the deep and the wonders of the astronomical universe. That God has put these things there. By his very breath, the skies became fair. He talks about that these things are but the outer fringe of his work. That God has put in places like the outer limits of the universe, the great depths of the sea, that he has shown us that he's there, he has shown us his vastness, and yet we can only get a tiny touch of us. And it's one of those things that Job really wants the answers to, and of course it's very difficult to him right now. If you know the poet Stephen Vincent Benet, he had an older brother, William Rose Benet, who was actually much more interested in Christian themes in his poetry, and he wrote a poem about whales that is actually using the whale as a metaphor for all of creation. And there's a passage that says, rain with a silver flail, sun with a golden ball, oceans wherein the whale swims, minnow small. That in the vastness of the ocean, even a whale is really just like a minnow. It's such a tiny little thing to God swimming around in these great oceans that he has created. And the point of it is for us to say, instead of looking at creation the way we have a tendency to do and use it just simply to refute the trivial arguments of atheists, for us to look at creation and instead ourselves be humbled by its vastness. Be humbled by the fact that a great whale or an elephant or some other creature, a ferocious beast like a lion or a tiger, they're just very tiny and docile to God. And that's the way it's meant to be. It's not an inadequacy in us personally so much as just a statement of our mortal human nature, that we'll never be able to perceive more than a small fraction of the things that God has made in this earth. And it's simply to give us a glimpse of how much vaster God is, and to build trust in him rather than inspiring us to somehow calculate out all his ways. The old Roman writer Lucretius used to say, a small thing can give analogy of great things and show the tracks of knowledge. And what Job is saying is something very similar. He's saying, when you get a glimpse of these small things, let yourself be humbled by it and let yourself realize that there's a grandeur there that we have only a dim sense of. 1 Corinthians 13, this is part of the great chapter on love, but it actually is a separate statement that's well worth looking at in its own right. He says, now we see only as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. So Paul presented a similar thought to Christians that, yes, we can only know dimly, looking in a mirror, or in the King James, in a glass darkly. The concept that, yes, it's the way it's meant to be here. It's not something that we're supposed to become frustrated about and beat ourselves up trying to come up with more scientific knowledge of God and reduce God to a little scientific specimen. It's something that we're meant to be humbled by and realize how much greater God is than we can grasp in this world. Now, the interesting thing is that Job immediately and very abruptly switches in chapter 27 to a brisk outburst of his pain. This is kind of the climax of his frustration, and we're not going to read the whole thing. I'll leave that to you, as we say in mathematics, I leave that to you as an exercise to pursue on your own. But in chapter 27, he expresses some very sharp thoughts. As surely as God lives, who has denied me justice, the Almighty who has made me taste bitterness of soul, as long as I have life within me, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, and my tongue will utter no deceit. I will never admit you are in the right. Till I die, I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my righteousness and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. So Job is very determined to do two things. He mentions two different things there. In regard to his friends, what's he determined to do? He's determined to put their wise teachings into practice, isn't he? He's determined that he's not going to believe they're right, no matter how much longer they babble on and ramble on about their theologies. What about himself? What's he determined for himself? That's right. He's going to stay the course. He's going to keep on a steady course of integrity and purity and conscience. And it's interesting. He's just not going to deal with them, but he's not rejecting God. He's just rejecting his friend's view of God. So he's going to hold clear to the same course that he's on. And he specifically mentions his conscience, that he's going to keep his conscience clean. He's going to maintain his righteousness to the best of his understanding. And it's kind of an interesting question. Is Job being stubborn, or is he, as he himself says, is he just demonstrating integrity? Or, as Deion Sanders would say, both. He's kind of demonstrating a little bit of both right there. He is getting kind of stubborn. He's getting kind of set here that his friends have kind of tired him out. He's kind of going to cease to listen to them. But he also is coming through this crisis with something to hold on to. He's realized that he cannot trust in the things of this world. All his possessions are gone. His family has been destroyed. But he's found out, you know, there's some things I can hang on to and be certain of. I can hang on to my belief in God. I can hang on to my understanding of what's right and wrong, and I won't let anything take that away from me. And when he says he has a clear conscience, he's saying, I'm going to do what I think and understand to be the best, to be right, to be what God wants. And he's going to stick with that. And it's very interesting how he's come through this crisis that's what he wants to stick with. See, a lot of people going through what Job had gone through would be determined to get back what they lost, or to have revenge on the people who hurt them, or to have somebody pay for it, or somebody apologize. But Job is not fixated on any of those things. He says, I've learned that I can't hang on to and cling to the things of this world. Even my own family, even my own friends, it can disappear. But I can hold on to what I know to be true. And that's a great lesson for us as Christians, because too often we view our relationship with God as just a means to an end. That I'm going to have a relationship with God and be good and give God what he wants so that he lets my life be easy and gives me what I want. And Job has realized, no, God, my relationship with God is for its own sake. That's the thing that I want. That's something no one can take away from me. This rest of this chapter, he kind of reverses the curse on his enemies. He says, may my enemies be like the wicked, my adversaries like the unjust. And it's kind of, he's going to turn back on his friends the things they've said to him. He's going to turn back on his friends the curses that they pronounced on him. They keep saying, Job, this bad stuff wouldn't have happened if you hadn't done something really bad. And so he's going to say, well, you guys are also, with your lack of compassion and consideration, you're pronouncing a curse on yourself. Romans 2:1. When you pass judgment on someone else, you are condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same thing. And the rest of this chapter, he says in verse 13, here's the fate God allots to the wicked, the heritage a ruthless man receives from the Almighty. However many his children, their fate is the sword. His offspring will never have enough to eat. The plague will bury those who survive him. Verse 16, though he heaps up silver like dust and clothes like pile of clay, what he lays up the righteous will wear. He's parodying his friends' views. His friends keep saying, oh, God always rewards good people right away and he always punishes bad people. Job's parodying his friends' views. He's saying, yeah, I can do it too. If you want to sit there and come up with ways that you imagine God will always render instant justice, I can do it too. And what God is going to do to you is reverse your curses on yourself. If you think that's what God does to wicked people, guess what? You've got that to look forward to as well, because of the way that you've been treating me. You know, there's an old story about Buddha when he was alive, how one day he was teaching a small group of his followers, and a man who disliked him came up and interrupted his little lesson. He started insulting Buddha and saying, "You're a fool. You don't know what's going on. You're not somebody these kids should listen to." And he told the people there, "This guy's an idiot. Don't listen to him. Don't pay any attention to him." And Buddha just stopped and patiently let this guy go on. And then after he was done, and he said, "Since you are here, would you mind answering an ethical question for me?" And this guy says, "Yeah, sure. What do you want to know?" And Buddha says, "Suppose one man buys another man a gift, but the second man is not able to accept the gift. To whom then would this gift belong?" And the guy said, "Well, it belongs to the first guy, obviously. Yo, so what?" And Buddha says, "Then in that case, I must decline to accept the gift of your abuse. You may keep it for yourself." And that's kind of what Job is doing. He's kind of reversing the curse. He's passing it off on someone else. Kind of like someone did to me yesterday. I went to a baseball game with Ron, and Ron has a wife who tries very hard to keep him out of trouble the way that mine does, and she kind of was very leery of us going to a game in the cold weather yesterday, and she told me that if Ron got sick sitting out in the cold weather at the baseball game, it was going to be taken out on me. Well, so this morning, when Ron is in perfectly good shape, I'm going to put that back on her. It's to my credit now that Ron had a good time and came away from the game healthy right there. Well, that's what Job is kind of doing. He's kind of turning things back on his friends and saying that you better be careful, because as Jesus said, with the measure you use, it's going to be measured to you. And it's a very good lesson to learn not to be so insensitive to people when they're struggling and suffering. Job 28 is really the kind of the gemstone of this big section of the book of Job. The search for wisdom. Job looking for now the nature of wisdom, the aspects of wisdom that really are most crucial to him. At the beginning of the chapter, he says, "There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness. He searches the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft, and places forgotten by the foot of man, far from men, he dangles and sways. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires come from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock as his eyes see all its treasures. He searches the sources of the rivers and brings hidden things to light." He talks about this endless search. In this passage, on a literal level, what does he portray people searching for? On a literal level, what is everybody searching for?
Wealth,
treasure, and not just money wealth, but what kind of wealth? They're mining and exploring the earth to find riches, treasures, precious metals. What can we find? We're not satisfied with what we've got. Let's find something that will give meaning. Whether it's money per se or whether it's natural resources, it's a characteristic of human beings to be endlessly searching for searching's sake, to be desiring for desire's sake. And he talks about the difference between humans and animals. He talks about the birds of prey, they don't have any sense of how far they can go. They just take what's immediately available to them. The falcon's eye can't see into the depths of the earth the way that humans do. Proud beasts and lions do not set foot every place where humans have gone. It's characteristic of humans not to be satisfied as animals in nature is with what you need. Humans aren't satisfied with just getting what they need. Humans have to seek to fulfill their desires as well. And humans invariably, in seeking one desire, usually discover something else, don't they? They usually discover additional desires. Once you have one desire fulfilled, you find more desires. And so when Job is talking about this search for meaning, it's more than just the search for wealth and natural resources. It's talking about this general human characteristic that we just have to have something more than what we've got. And there's an interesting comparison. There are the three books of Job and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes all tackle this concept of wisdom and knowledge, because it's knowledge and wisdom that Job is pursuing. But he uses the natural activities as metaphors in that. And, you know, it's interesting. Job was written so many millennia ago, when mining and engineering and science was in its infancy, and yet this description could equally well apply to the things that humans occupy themselves with today. The way that humans are frantically looking for some new product, some new toy, new solution to some practical problem. They just won't be satisfied with what they have, and they miss out on things that are more important spiritually because of that. And the book of Job portrays the search for knowledge from one point of view, whereas Proverbs and Ecclesiastes have a lot of verses that I'm sure are familiar to you about wisdom that come from a different point of view. And it's very interesting, the last verse of Job 28, you can compare it with the last verses of Ecclesiastes, and you'll find an interesting parallel. The difference is, though, is the book of Proverbs is really an optimistic search for wisdom. Most of Proverbs was written by King Solomon when he was young and had a good relationship with God. And so the Proverbs are very optimistic, very confident. A lot of very good practical advice, and in fact, we'll study this summer. We'll study the book of Proverbs. Very optimistic, confident look at wisdom. Ecclesiastes was written when the author, Solomon, was much older, and his good relationship with God is gone. And he's gone and tried a lot of other things to find different meanings in his life, and what's happened?
Didn't work.
He's depressed. He's discouraged. And so the last verse of Ecclesiastes says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I should have just stuck with what I had. And that the end of Ecclesiastes, really, it's not meant to be the final word. It's really meant to say, I should have just started where I was all along. Because Job is going to say the same thing at the end of Job, but it's for a different point of view. Job is not a person who blew it. Job is a person who suffers unjustly. Job is trying to use his sufferings and trials in a positive way. And when he comes down at the end of the book and says, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding, he knows that's not the end. That's the starting point. That's the difference between him and Solomon. He's going to come through his trials ready to move ahead. He says, to fear the Lord, that's just the starting point. And I'm glad that I found it. Solomon is regretfully looking back and said, yeah, I should have just started from there all along. Instead of building things, and instead of collecting things, and instead of exploiting people and accumulating material things that couldn't fulfill me. And it's one of the big differences between Job and Solomon and the way they dealt with things. And so these three books are kind of an interesting comparison study on their own for that reason. Well, what Job moves on to then in the next part of chapter 28, in chapter 28, verse 12, and actually you can compare verse 12 with verse 20 because it's kind of a refrain. Verse 12, he says, where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? And this is the kind of the whole concept of this part of the book of Job. In verse 20, you'll notice there's a subtle difference. He says, where then does wisdom come from? And where does understanding dwell? There's kind of two different questions he asks. Where is wisdom found? And then the second question is slightly different. Instead of where is it found, what's the second question? Verse 20. Where does it come from? Right. In other words, once I find it, who put it there? And so Job is really interested in tackling these questions because he has seen the inadequacy of human wisdom, including his own, to deal with his problems. And so the first thing he realizes here in this next little passage, he realizes that wisdom is not for sale. He's talking about all these things that humans do in their endless search for meaning, but he says, verse 12, where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. And he goes on to give further analogies of the way the riches of the world just cannot purchase wisdom. He realizes that what's lacking in his wisdom is not a lack of his effort. It's not a lack of financial resources to purchase it with. It's not even a lack of righteousness on his part. What is lacking is the fact that wisdom in this life, in this world, is never going to be here in more than these little glimpses of God that he gets. And this is what Job is coming to see, that instead of putting meaning in the big obvious things of this world and in the things that people put their false security in, he's learning to put his security in God. And right now, he doesn't even feel God's presence very well. But what he realizes the inadequacy of earthly riches. And Job is making a different conclusion than a lot of people make when they're faced with that realization. Job says, you have human riches, they're going to let me down. They can disappear in a second. My own family, they can disappear without me doing anything to be able to stop it. My friends can turn against me. But instead of being resentful of that, it's driving him where? It's driving him to God. It's driving him to seek God's presence, to treasure God's presence. And even though he says some things about God sometimes that are kind of bitter, he still knows that's where I need to be. I'm going to stick with God. And it's a great example of Job as an example of genuine faith and seeking God for God's sake, not for the earthly toys that he will provide. And this whole concept of wisdom and knowledge in itself, of course, is something that's not only of importance in Christianity, it's of course in importance in philosophy as well. And certainly it's a very popular topic amongst philosophers, the search for wisdom. And it's interesting to kind of compare the thoughts of philosophers with the thoughts of someone like Job, who is truly wrestling with this. Philosophers have a term called epistemology, which is basically the branch of philosophy that has to do with the nature of wisdom and how you obtain wisdom. And it's kind of interesting, and it's one of these things that, you know, when I was in school, I spent many hours in classes slogging through books written about this, and they tend to really jelly your brain, and so all those hours that I spent on it, why shouldn't you have to deal with it for a few minutes here? Epistemology basically is, what is wisdom and where does it come from? Exactly what Job is asking. There's two basic models that are used by philosophers, and they're kind of the extreme positions. And they can, to put it in simple terms, there's the pyramid model and there's the boat model. Philosophers look at wisdom as either, in a sense, these are not universal, but they're popular analogies. A pyramid means that you have a big bottom layer and then successively smaller layers that are built nice and securely on that pyramid. And a pyramid, the pyramid model of knowledge is, you get some things you know are absolutely true, and you build from there. And the pyramid model of epistemology is the belief that human beings can know it all, that we can form our beliefs on absolutely secure foundations. The boat model, again to use the simple term for it, is, if you think of a boat is perfectly constructed and fits together perfectly in itself. But to do anything, what does it need? It needs to float on something external and uncertain. And so the boat model is, well, all we can do is construct an internally consistent model of our knowledge and our beliefs. And if you think about those, the pyramid model is very pretentious to think that a mortal human being who only lives a tiny lifespan of the vastness of the age of the world and of the size of the world could ever build something that perfect. And the boat model kind of says right at the beginning, I'm not going to try for too much here. I'm not going to be too ambitious. I'm just going to try to get something self-contained here. You know, there's a couple other very important concepts in philosophy, in this realm of epistemology. They're a little bit deeper. You might have heard of a guy named René Descartes from back in the Renaissance. He is famous for a certain saying. In Latin, it's cogito ergo sum. In English, it's I think, therefore I am. Descartes was interested in the nature of knowledge and how reliable it is. And he took everything that he can see, everything that he thinks he's learned, everything that people have told him, and deconstructed it down to the extreme. And he realized that anything you perceive, anything you see, anything someone says can always be a deception. In the extreme example, you could be dreaming this. You could be having a nightmare about sitting in a Bible class and having some penguin-crazed anarchist talking about a bunch of heretical doctrines. This could all be a dream. It could be a dream for me. I could be dreaming that all of you characters exist. I don't know where in my diseased mind I would have gotten the concepts for some of you, but it could be all a dream for me. Someone could be deceiving you. It could be one of those inhumane psychology experiments where we're all on some horrible drug that some alien has fed us to get our perceptions and reactions. And Descartes realized that the only thing he could be certain about is if someone's deceiving him with all this, the only way that someone can deceive him is if he's there to be deceived. So if he thinks, then he's got to exist. That's the only, and he used that as kind of his foundation of all knowledge from that. And very interestingly, that led him to believe that there must be a divine being as well because of that, if you read his philosophy works. There's another one more, and this warning sign did go on, so you don't complain to the management about this. One more of this boring topic. Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, had a different example that I remember very vividly from school that actually fits in very well with what Job is saying. Plato likened our knowledge of the world to a bunch of people sitting in a cave. It's called the cave analogy, Plato's cave analogy. There's a bunch of people sitting in a cave where all we can look at is the back wall of the cave. And behind us is the real world, but we can't turn and see it. And all we can see is on the back wall of the cave the shadows of the things from the real world as the sun casts a shadow in there. And so we see shadows of people and animals and buildings, but that's all we can ever see. And Plato said, imagine, if you will, if someone somehow escaped from that cave and went out and saw the real stuff and then came back and tried to tell the rest of us what it was about. Imagine how nutty you would think he was, because your conception of the world is just these shadows on the wall. And Plato was not a Christian, of course, but he was a searcher for divine meaning. And he was saying that this is what it's like on this earth. There's a reality out there. And Plato equally criticized the conventional Greek views of gods as being trivial and unacceptable, because he said there's a spiritual realm out there that cannot be described in our little physical terms, because all we're seeing is the little shadows. There's something a lot greater out there. And if we want to have any kind of wisdom worthy of the name, we've got to seek that. So I'll leave you with that. Plato did, by the way, have another analogy. He had an analogy that likened the different kinds of knowledge to different species of birds. And if you're not nice to me sometime, I'll give you all the thorough details of that little analogy right there. But moving on back to the text, he comes back to this refrain back in verse 20 of chapter 28. He says, where then does wisdom come from? That's the second question. And where does understanding dwell? It's hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. Yeah, this kind of ties back in with chapter 26. He said something similar before he got this far. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells, for he views the ends of the earth. He sees everything under the heavens. God understands the way because he alone sees it all, and he alone has been here the whole time. It's not faith or confidence when scientists or philosophers or preachers or theologians presume to build this perfect pyramid of knowledge. It's simply presumption. And it's not faithlessness when we say to ourselves, there are a lot of important things about God that we can only dimly understand. That's just humility. That's truth. Accepting that. And accepting that God is not going to even be able to give us all of the answers, because there's so many answers that it would take an eternity to explain. To explain some things would just be impossible for us with our mortal minds and mortal lifespans to grasp. And so what Job is coming back to is not, he's finally realizing that his demands for God to explain everything are it's not something God can fulfill. He's been thinking all this time, the reason why God's not answering me is because he just doesn't want to explain it to me. He doesn't care. And now he's realizing, no, it's because it's not possible. It's not possible for me to grasp everything, because it would take more than my mortal mind to understand, and it would take more than my mortal lifetime for God to explain it to us. And we tend to use these terms, and to some degree they're interchangeable, but three different terms: wisdom, knowledge, and information. And it's kind of I don't mean to be pedantic. There's kind of a shade of meaning there that you don't want to take too far, but it's a worthwhile concept. There's an old quote, last quote of the day, old quote from T.S. Eliot, whom you all know, and nod your heads or I will tell you all about T.S. Eliot, and you won't like that any more than you've liked the other stuff. But T.S. Eliot said, all of our knowledge only brings us nearer to our own ignorance, and all of our knowledge only brings us nearer to our deaths. Where is the wisdom that we've lost because of our knowledge? Where is the knowledge that we've lost because of our information? And it's a quote that could have been made today, but it was actually made back in the 1930s, which I know you know because you know all about T.S. Eliot. But he's saying is, in our search for information, factoids, interesting little things that we can go around and share our friends and tell them that we know all these fascinating little factoids, we miss out on true knowledge. The so-called information era exalts these trivialities and trumpets them forth as important controversial things or things that every hip-with-it person needs to know. And when you fixate on the information and the factoids, you lose true knowledge. You lose the understandings of how things work. But then Eliot was pointing out that there's even another level by that. There's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is understanding how things work, knowing how to do things, knowing how to get people to do things. But even that is trivial compared with wisdom. And in the search for information, you miss out on knowledge. But in the search for knowledge, you miss out on wisdom. And within the church, we're far from immune to that because we're so often fixated on how to get people to do stuff, how to get people to do the things we think they should be doing, how to persuade people that we're right. And you miss out on true wisdom, which is what Job's finding. Job is finding true wisdom, and wisdom looks a lot smaller. It's like a whale becoming a minnow in the vast ocean of what you can know about God. But Job realizes that's where it's at. That's what he needs. And so when he says that God understands the way and sees all, he says in verse 27, God looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and he tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. And what Job is coming to is not the pessimistic conclusion of Ecclesiastes that, yeah, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and I should have just stayed there all along. He's coming to say, yes, I've seen it. And this is only the starting point. Your fearing God is just a starting point. And instead of getting bogged down, and I think you know what the fear of the Lord is, not sitting there cowering in a corner for God to zap you. It's something much different and much more reverent. But even that, we tend to get lost in figuring out what that is to realize that Job's not saying it's an end. It's a beginning. It's a starting point. God looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And see, what Job has realized, it's not just that he tested it by his superior knowledge. God tests wisdom also by his character, by his nature. God's wisdom does not only reflect his superior knowledge, it reflects his superior character, his graciousness, his righteousness, his immortality. God's wisdom is not merely a case of better factual information. It's a question of a better and higher perspective. And that's what Job, through all his struggles, has come to see. And it's something we can hold on to, too, in our own struggle and search for meaning. Trivia time. Sports trivia this week. It's even about college football for all you Buckeye fans. And it's about college football bowl games for all you Buckeye fans. I have written on the chalkboard the names of five college football bowl games. One of them is fake. So which of the following is not a real college football bowl game, either current or past? And even though some of these sound kind of goofy, four of them are real bowl games. Only one is fake. If one was real, then it would be a little bit easier because they're all kind of crazy. So which is the fake? Is the refrigerator bowl fake? Or do you think that you all think there really was a refrigerator bowl then? How about the Vulcan bowl? Is the Vulcan bowl fake or is that a real one? How about the salad bowl? Is that fake or is that a real one? How about the poinsettia bowl? Is that the fake one or is that a real one? How about the phosphorus bowl? Is that a fake one or is that the real one? Well, some of them are pretty ludicrous. Well, now, one of these, some of you have ties to Abilene Christian, right? Didn't some of you go there and have ties there? You will be pleased to know that Abilene Christian's football team has a storied past because in 1950, the football team from Abilene Christian won the Refrigerator Bowl. The Refrigerator Bowl used to take place in Evansville, Indiana, which for a long time in the 40s and 50s was called the refrigerator capital of the United States. And so the refrigerator companies got together and sponsored this bowl game. And it was won 1 year by Abilene Christian. So those of you who have ties to Abilene Christian, when your Buckeye friends start boasting, ask them how many times the Buckeyes have won the refrigerator bowl, because there's one area in which Abilene Christian has a big advantage over the Buckeyes, because it doesn't exist anymore, and so the Buckeyes will never win the refrigerator bowl. The Vulcan Bowl obviously sounds like something from Star Trek. This was a real bowl game. Vulcan is the Roman god of fire, and he's usually depicted in mythology as a blacksmith making things out of metal. It used to take place in Birmingham, Alabama, which was one of the great steel-making capitals of the United States for a long time back in the, this is back in the 30s and 40s. This is a little Buckeye trivia, because one of the remaining bowls that's real is the first, is the answer to another very important trivia question. What's the first bowl game that Woody Hayes ever won? And is the 1951 Salad Bowl. When Woody Hayes was the coach of the team in Miami, in Oxford, Ohio, the Miami, Ohio team, in 1951, he took them to the Salad Bowl, where they defeated Arizona State in the Salad Bowl. So that's a little Buckeye trivia for you. That's a, you can stump most of your Buckeye friends, ask them what the first game, first bowl game Woody Hayes ever won was. That was actually what got him hired at Ohio State. He took a little team from Miami and beat Arizona State in the Salad Bowl. So there's only two left.
Phosphorus
is the fake. It's too bad, because they're missing a good marketing tie-in, you know, the only bowl game that glows in the dark, and there, someone's missing out there. The Poinsettia Bowl actually still exists. The Poinsettia Bowl is in San Diego. This one still exists. The other three were discontinued some years ago, but they were all around for a good amount of time. Some of the names today are even goofier than Refrigerator Bowl and Vulcan Bowl and Salad Bowl, because a lot of them now have these tacky corporate nicknames, which I am not going to tell you, because I'm not going to give them free advertising. But there's one bowl that's called the Pizza Bowl, because it's sponsored by this certain pizza chain. There's one called the Potato Bowl, because it's sponsored by this certain potato company. And there's some of them that don't even bother with having a theme to it. It's just the somethingsomething.com bowl, and it's just hideous, you know. Now, it's bad enough that, you know, you can imagine a team clinching its spot in the Refrigerator Bowl with their last game of the season. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we win, we're going to the Refrigerator Bowl. You can just imagine what a thrill that was to announce. And today it's, we're going to the somethingsomethingsomething.com bowl. Hooray for our team. And it's just really goofy. And it's something that it just shows the depths of ingenuity and creativity and resourcefulness of the human mind when there's an absolutely unimportant purpose at stake. In this case, just squeezing out a few extra dollars out of somebody. The human mind is infinitely resourceful when it comes to scraping up a few extra dollars. When it comes up to this utterly trivial thing of creating these little pageants every December and January. And you could use 100 other examples. The human mind is very creative and ingenious when it comes to politics or theology or religion or proving that our culture is better than someone else's or manipulating other people into doing what we want them to do. Corporations that manipulate people into buying their worthless products by making them feel guilty or worthless if they don't buy the right brand of toothpaste or the right kind of car. The human mind is filled with resourcefulness and creativity when it comes to these trivial purposes. But the human mind is stumped when it comes to seeking real wisdom, real understanding, real insight. The human mind, as Job has realized, is woefully inadequate. And instead of trying to simply perfect our human knowledge in our approach to ministry and belief and faithfulness, instead, it's much more important and much more healthy to realize the depths of humility that understanding God's creation and God's wisdom call for. To realize that we don't have all the answers. We don't need all the answers. We don't need to give people a comprehensive theology with all the answers. What we need to do is introduce them to the living God. Help them to get to know the living God the way Job has come to see him, as an important and precious thing in his own sake. This is what Job has come to through all this suffering and struggling. And Job has reached a special realization there that's well worth our emulating, instead of just trying to, you know, instead of running out there now and trying to come up with a plan for the Phosphorus Bowl so that you can make money out of it. Realize the silliness of trying to apply human wisdom principles and human knowledge principles to trying to figure out God and trying to stick him in a little box. Realize how much greater he is than that. Be humbled by God and realize what a special privilege it is to know that God, to know Him for His own sake, and that it's a good thing that what He wants from you is not just to make your life perfect. It's a good thing that what He wants for you is to you to be able to sit with Him and talk to Him and know Him face to face. Thank you so much for your patient attendance. We'll be back next week.